I'm Catherine Connors. I am 40 years old. It is March 13th, 2011. I'm in Austin, Texas at the South by Southwest Interactive Conference, and I'm talking to Scott Stratton, who is just, I consider, one of my greatest friends.
I'm Scott Stratton, 35 years old. It is March 13th, 2011, in Austin, Texas at South by Southwest, and I am a friend of the awesome Catherine. And there you go.
So we've thrown awesome into the discussion like right off the bat.
That's the only way it can go. That's right.
And when we talked about this before, we talked about talking about being parents, talking about our kids, talking about kids in an age of digital media, which I want to do, but I want to start out by framing it in the context of both of us being working parents, self-employed parents, you being, you know, as I said earlier over coffee, an awesomeologist. You know, before we get to the whole kid thing, I think we need to set up the awesomeology part of it, or the working life part of it,
right,
to talk about how we relate to our kids, how we hope to inspire our kids, how our kids inspire us in the context of what we're doing in the rest of our lives when we're not actively parenting in the conventional sense.
I think it's all the term actively parenting too is it throws everything off, because when you work from home, when you run a company, and then you have all these obligations, which are also in your environment of your personal environment and your work environment, that means the line's blurred, and it's really tough, I find, to manage that a lot. That's why for me, I'll flee to a Starbucks or something like that to just focus. And you realize you go into the place, it's the most chaotic place you can go into with the noise, the music, and the people, and it's much more relaxing and focused than seeing that there's laundry to be done, or seeing, you know, there's something there, or my new puppy peeing on the floor or something like that. I got to go. And now we just moved into a house where I have an office with a door.
Right.
And that actually has changed the psychology of what I'm doing. I go in there and I'm in work mode.
Yeah.
And when you work, and we talk about the oatmeal poster, the joke about how working from home and how it's looked at, whether it's other parents. And I'm the one they call to say, well, you know, can you go do the field trip, or can you do this, or can the kids come over to your house afterwards because you work from home?
Mm-hmm.
Like it's a hobby or something. And do they not know that working from home means you never stop working, right? There's no shut off at 5 o'clock, and there's no, and that's hard as a parent too, though, to get there. So I think that, you know, setting the tone of, I think being a working parent who works from home is not one that's talked about a lot. And especially when you're the one, you know, that you're the one supporting things, and you have to have business. It's not a hobby. It's not a part. It's not a nice to have. It's not a thing where I want to write a blog to get free stuff, and that's all I'm going to do. It's a job.
It's really interesting to hear you say that, because it's something that when it does get talked about, it does get talked about actually, but it's usually in relation to moms working from home, and that there's this idea that there's so much slippage between being a work-at-home mom and a stay-at-home mom that many people can't distinguish. But it's actually really gratifying to hear that a dad who's working at home experiences, you know, the same sort of thing, the same, you know, has the assumptions in the neighborhood or from the other school parents that, well, that's the guy who can, you know, go last minute with some cupcakes.
What does he do? Yeah. Why does he can show up here in a ball cap and that? Is he unemployed? He's looking for work, isn't he? You know?
Well, yeah.
Yeah. And this whole preconceived notion of what it is. And it's work-at-home parent, you know, versus, but work-at-home mom literally has become a niche.
Yeah.
Right, it's become like the cool thing to talk about today, and that vendors want to and advertisers want to get around that demographic. I'm like, what, really? And then there's work at home moms who are accountants or consultants or virtual assistants who spew the fact that they're work at home moms in their marketing. And I did a it's in the book, and I did a video about it, a ranting about it, that, you know, being a work at home mom as a label, it's actually bad for business, where people don't realize that. I don't want to think of what I think you're doing at home, where, you know, whatever the bias is, it actually is not good for you if your market isn't other work-at-home moms or parents. But the key word there is work.
Yeah.
But it's also getting respect from your significant other. That's a huge thing, too.
That's
everything.
And I want to talk about that. Before we talk, well, that's going to tie into this. You were talking about all of a sudden having an office at home. And I actually just a couple of months ago set up my own office at home, and I actually moved my children into a room together in bunk beds so that I could free up that particular space and make that my workspace. Yeah. And it's I'm finding it's an interesting psychology, because I've actually written about it in terms of it being a quote-unquote mom cave, right? Yeah. Although for me it's a workspace, but I talk about it in terms of it's also, it's a sanctuary, it's a space of inspiration, it's a space of creativity, and the because my work is creative, you know, that is my workspace. Mm-hmm. But the number one question I've gotten when I've written about it or spoken about it is, do you keep everybody out? Are your children allowed in? Is your husband allowed in? Yeah. Do you have a do not disturb sign? And it's an interesting question for me, because there's a yes and no answer. When I am working, door is shut. Do not disturb. And I have actually piled up pillows and stuff furniture against the door to keep them from pushing their way in, right? I've actually blockaded my family out.
Yeah.
But the rest of the time, if I can be disturbed, I leave it open. And sometimes my daughter sits on the floor and does her coloring. And for me, there are times when that doesn't really work. But for me, I find kind of some level of inspiration from having the familial awesome nearby, of having that kind of leak into the room a little bit. Not all times. There are times when the door needs to be shut, and as I said, furniture pushed up in front of it. But I mean, do you find that working at home, working in your home space, you know, knowing that your son's things, you know, are just on the other side of the door, that he might be there, you know, does that, you know, do you incorporate that into, you know?
Yeah, it's where he's at the age now where, you know, he's 9. So when he comes in, he'll come and say hi. And same thing applies for anything, which is doors open, come in, doors closed, don't.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's more open than closed, but he'd come in to give me a hug, say hi, just to know I'm there. And then he just gets bored.
And wanders away.
You don't bring your kids into your cubicle in the workplace and say, hang out with me. It's not like the number one thing on their 10 things to do this week is to hang out in a cubicle. So so it's enough to say, hey, dad is here. He's doing this. You know, I got a picture of him on the desk. And so it's still, I don't want the separation to be so psychological to him that daddy's at work, I'm at home. One of the advantages of working from home is I can be there for him. If he has a question about why is the sky blue, I can answer it. Mm-hmm. But there's also a level that you set to say, look, I need to focus and I need to do that. But treating them with respect for it. Mm-hmm. And I think if we just put a sign on the door and say, get out, it's going to want them to make, it's a kid, it's going to want them to go in more. You know, you walk by a door here somewhere and it says, don't go in. You're like, what's in there? You know, and that's, that's how it works. So I think that that's a huge thing of, and the ability to create that space I hadn't had for the past 4 or 5 years. Like, we were in a one-bedroom condo with three of us. There's nothing. Like, literally, you're sleeping on top of each other. And I found it next to impossible to work. Literally, I'd be at, like, the joke was the coffee shop was, like, that was my booth, my name on it, and that was my office. And, like, the revenues have gone down greatly since I've got my own home office. But we're back to the point, especially about, I think about your significant other's respect.
Yeah, I was just going to move on to that.
Because that is if you don't have that support, I think any kind of position where we're writing or anything else, and creative, you need that mind space to do it. And if you're feeling browbeaten about it, or you're feeling guilty about it, it's not coming out. And then we're not effective at what we do. And then, you know, why are we doing it?
Yeah. I mean, the cliche about the tension that can emerge in relationships around working at home, you know, is that one's partner sees one, you know, in one's pajamas, you know, with a mug of coffee, tapping away on a computer, and it's like, what real work can't involve, you know, pajamas? But I actually think, you were alluding to this, it's more complicated than that, because it's, especially when it's creative work. Like, I think if I sat at my computer and did data entry in my home office all day, my husband might think differently of it. But because I'm doing creative work, because I'm writing, I'm sitting, I'm drinking coffee, sometimes I, like, lay down. I have a little, like, sofa couch, you know, in my office. I'll lay down and stare at the ceiling. And he sometimes struggles with, because he doesn't do that kind of creative work, that it's, that's so ephemeral to him that he sometimes struggles with the, are you actually working? Why could you not come talk to me right now? Or let's deal with this, or can't we do a run to Home Depot if he happens to be at home? Because it's such a, it's a vague and ephemeral thing that's difficult for him to wrap his mind around. Yeah. So do you find that?
Totally. And the advantage to work from home is also the disadvantage.
Yeah.
That you can go and do anything you want.
Yeah.
You can go to the school and pick a kid up when he's sick or she's sick. You can go on that field trip. And that's where, and I'm lucky that I have that my girlfriend, Tammy, is totally supportive of it. Mm-hmm. She understands it. Now, for me, it was a different, it's a whole different situation for me. Where I was before, I had no workspace, is that, you know, my girlfriend's got a brain injury. And so I would see her, and I'd be working, and you can't focus on what you're doing when you see the person you love in pain. And she's still functional, but in pain all the time. And there's no way I'm being creative. There's no way I'm going to come up with a witty blog post when I'm sitting there trying to fix somebody I can't fix. And so she gets it. She actually was, she's the number one supporter of this office. Like when we got to found, got the new house, she walked in and goes, there's your office right there. And it was 100%. And there was no doubt about it. So I'm lucky. And I know people who have not, like really browbeaten about it. Saying, you know, what do? You don't do anything. You know, you can, and you, here's all your chores you can do today because you're home.
Yeah.
But I know, and we all know, I think anybody who's worked in an office knows that you can do the least work in the history of mankind in an office.
Totally.
In a cubicle.
Yeah.
Like when I worked in a cubicle back in the days when I, you know, was employable, I literally did nothing, and I'm not making this up, for a year. That I was a training, a sales trainer, and the only time when I'd go out and fly to Chicago or something, train people, other than that, I had nothing to do. But I was far enough removed from my boss that I didn't have to do anything either, because I was getting the results in the sales training, record numbers, everything, but I did nothing. And I thought it would be the greatest job in the world, and it was horrible. Yeah. I literally would have a lap time of going around the office without running, just see how quickly I could get around the with a clipboard. And so literally, the art of nothing excels in the workplace. So there's a psychology. But it's also the reason why workplaces still don't allow people to work from home. They're like, if I can't see you, you know, I'm like, no, if you see me, I'm probably not doing anything.
Yeah.
Right? And that's still a psychological thing. So it's not only home respect, it's workplace respect. And I think if more people could work from home, who people who can manage it, because there are people who aren't. They would go home and they'd literally sit in their pajamas and and watch Dr. Phil and not do the work. But it's holding accountable for results versus FaceTime. And that's a whole other world of things, too.
There's a whole other element of this that I think is interesting, and that is, it's not just the working at home. I think when someone is fortunate enough to do something that they really, really, really love, everybody else's opinion kind of shifts and to a place of assuming that it's not really work then if you love it enough, right? And I get this a little bit from my husband, because you know, I feel so tremendously fortunate to be able to spend my life writing and then on the other side of what I do and talking about social media and pursuing causes and doing good. And it's like, I'm like, I love it. I'm lucky. Like, I would not choose to go watch television or, you know, do whatever else recreationally, because I love what I do. But that makes, in my experience, not only your partner and your family, but sort of even communities think, well, that's not really work if you love it that much.
Do you think that, do you think that's envy? Do you think it's something where they're saying whether that's not fair?
I do. I think that a big part of it is envy. But I think it's actually sort of this deeply ingrained idea that work with the capital W is something that we don't or possibly even shouldn't really enjoy. Like, to the extent that even when we use work as a descriptive term, like, that's work, that was real work.
Right.
It's, we're implying that it's harder, it's difficult, or it's unpleasant. And I think that actually ties into parenting as well, that even 100%. It's to the extent that because mothers and fathers are supposed to love, you know, with every cell in their heart, every moment of parenting, that's why parenting's not work, because you love it. And you're supposed to love it. And so it, you know, even though there are things that we would all agree are difficult about parenting, for the most part, it's something that you're supposed to love. So how can it actually be work?
I used to talk about work-life balance. I used to do a lot of the speaking in the cheesy motivational area. And my whole point was, if you consider work one thing and life another, you can't. 5 days a week can't equal 2 days a week. You know, the whole living for the weekend type of thing. And that work is the majority of your life. How sad that for some people would start weeping when you tell them that. But that has to be, that you have to treat it like your life. And but I always hear that phrase. I've heard that phrase since coming out of college. And people have, well, you got to pay your dues, though. You've got to do the trenches. You know, when you retire,
you've got to suffer.
Yeah, you have to suffer. And when you hit freedom 83 now, I guess it is, whenever you can retire nowadays with pension plans and everything, where I'll automatically get knee-high socks, move to Florida, take up gardening and golf, you know, and off I go. And I said, no, I want to enjoy it now. Like, if we want to talk about work, and we're talking about, we're filling out forms for today, but retired. Like, if you want, I've been retired from work for almost 10 years. Like, literally, I'm thinking of, I have to.
Freedom 25.
Yeah. Just a jackass. Freedom 25. And that's what it was for me, though, because mm-hmm. I have never felt I'm going to work. Mm-hmm. And but I also know it's actually a great indicator for me and as a company to when to stop offering certain services or working with certain people, when it starts to feel like that old school work thing. Yeah. I have to do it. You know, if I wanted to hate what I did, I'd get a mm-hmm. job, you know, yeah. and get a paycheck because it's every 2 weeks and I'd get a constant pay. And mm-hmm. I don't think people get it that to get to this point or get to the point where we are to work from home and enjoy it. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot that went into that. Yes, ma'am.
I think it's true. But how do you get brave enough to take that leap? Can you right. talk about taking that leap?
Now, for me, the leap, so the leap of going from paycheck to, how do you take that leap of being brave enough to do that? And it takes a set to be able to do these things, to go out there and jump,
set.
Right?
Yeah.
And that's a shirt. And so for me, it was, I did what a lot of people did, whereas I put one toe out there. And started getting to know it. So it was casual, it was part-time, was doing some consulting on the side, the moonlighting that we all do. Mm-hmm. But I of course, because I'm a spaz, I did it the wrong way. And as I was doing the training manager job at this company, but walking around doing nothing for a year, I said, okay, that's it. Mm-hmm. I travel over the weekends for you guys. I save you money. I'm going to work from home when I'm not doing training. And then I will come in and do all the training you want. And the president, and I said, if this is on a Friday. And I said, if you don't let me do that, that's fine, but I'm not coming back.
Right.
And I said, it sounds like an ultimatum, and it is, but I can't do this anymore. And he said, well, Chris, because he has no idea who I am. He calls me Chris. Like, well, Chris, I don't think we're ready for this telecommuting thing, and so we'll see you on Monday. And I said, I don't think you heard me. And I walked out, and I had 64 cents in the bank. Right. I kid you not, 64 cents. Owen was 3 weeks old.
Wow.
I didn't say I was smart. But do you think I got motivated?
Yeah.
Right? And what I did, I exhausted mm-hmm. a line of credit, and I exhausted my credit cards. And it was worth every penny.
Yeah.
I think I'm still paying it off.
So it was really, that's the classic leap, you right. know, coupled with maybe, you know, a nudge, you know, yeah. when somebody's being an asshole.
See, and usually it happens, it's a layoff, or it's one mm-hmm. of those, it's just an explosion point to say, you know what, enough.
Yeah.
But I also believe that a lot of people aren't meant to run their
no.
own thing.
No, and that's a huge thing, I yeah. think, that a lot of people aren't meant to do it. A lot of people just aren't going to take that leap, you know, either because they don't know how to swim when they land in the yeah. water, or they're not inclined to want to swim, or they don't like water anyway, and they're afraid of fish.
All of the above, yeah.
All of the above. Yeah. See, for me, it was interesting because there was, in many very important respects, I have never had a real job.
Right.
So I was not coming from, I did everything in my power all of my life to avoid becoming a grown-up. I went.
Still doing a
traveled
good job.
For a I'm doing yeah. an excellent yeah. job. I'm successful at not being a grown-up. That should be my profession, not a grown-up.
Professional non-grown-up.
Professional non-grown-up. You know, I went to university. I did well in university. I excelled in some topics. I decided I would continue studying those topics. In part because I always wanted to be a writer, and it was giving me an opportunity to write, and a lot of people patting me on the head and going, you're so smart. You're so smart. And I stayed in graduate school for years and years and contemplated offers from, you know, very big and important universities, and, you know, thought a lot about, well, I could kick this into overdrive and work harder and work towards being the professional academic. Mm. You know, and I eventually, you know, sort of got there. I worked my way through graduate school, but graduate school isn't grown-up land, neither is the academy. Even when you become a lecturer, as I did, a sessional one, you know, it's not a grown-up space. You're wandering around campuses with, you know, kids in their late teens and 20s, and everybody's carrying books, and everybody's drinking beer after class, and you never have to grow up. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until I had my first child and found myself in the world of social media quite accidentally because of, you know, Googling spit up and depression, because yeah. the two go together.
Yeah, yeah.
And started writing. I found myself having fallen off this non-grown-up world of the academy, right. you know, into, you know, the different waters of something elseness that yeah. that for me was writing. And so it's, you know, when I've been asked, how did you make that decision? Why'd you make the leap? I actually continued teaching for a year and a half after I had Amelia. writing away, writing my mummy blog, but feeling very passionately that this was an important extension of what I had been doing, because I'd been writing academically about women and mothers and the history of philosophy. But I just eventually I found myself living the life that I always wanted.
Right.
And I think there was a lot of intent there. Like, I just went, hey, I'm doing this. I'm going to keep doing this. I'm just going to gonna keep swimming.
Yeah.
You know, but I never actually made until I did quit teaching for good.
Right.
You know, there wasn't that dramatic moment that you had where you go, 64 cents to the bank, but you know what? I am still jumping off this cliff.
Drive home. A little gas to drive home, but I'm good to go. But I think there's also, though, that there's along those ways, too, there's ways that either things will stop you in your tracks or they'll motivate you. Like, I had certain family members say to me, you need to grow up. You need to go back and get a job. And you have responsibilities. And I said, I have a responsibility not to get
You
one.
Still get that?
Oh, yeah. We have it very rarely, because I've turned really lippy in my older years. And so more behind my back than anything else. But now but now that the company's successful, nobody's got a problem with it. But they don't realize how long it takes to build something. And that, and then I had success really early. And that was probably the worst thing that could have happened to me, is we created these videos online, millions of views each one, people, clients banging down the door. You know, our second year, we pulled in maybe $250,000, and my overhead was literally 1% of that. And so it's just like, I'm just a king. I guess it's year two. Let's check out year three. And then the recession hit, and I didn't see it coming like most people. And, you know, I billed out maybe a 1 year of $16,000. And, you know, and you're like, wait a second. Where's the money that I had before? And I, as you know, by the 64 cent thing I said, I'm not exactly the best financial planner there is in the world, right? You know? And so for me, it was a real shock of seeing, well, you know, this is what you get. You get the highs. And it's just, to me, it's a lot like parenting, though.
Yeah.
You don't get one without the other. You get the highs and the lows. And the lows make the highs better. And the highs can make the lows more severe because of that vested interest. And growing a company, to me, although totally different, has a lot to do with raising a child.
Yeah.
It's your emotion.
Yeah.
It's your sweat. It's everything that's gone into it. I won't say blood, because if you're bleeding, you shouldn't be doing anything
in
the company.
You should probably sit down.
Get some first aid. But the ability to understand that, and people don't get that part. I really don't think that's the part, too, as they're saying. And when, and people just, I was talking to someone about this yesterday, and they just become flippant to your success, which was, oh, you can just go on Twitter and you just tweet something and it works.
Yeah.
Or you just can go, you just speak. Mm-hmm. Right? That's what I do now. Literally, that's what I make money, is I go speak. And like, well, you speak. Like, yeah, I know. And I'm damn good at it. Mm-hmm. And they also didn't see the decade that built up to this point.
Yeah.
Or the 70,000 tweets that got to the one tweet I just sent.
Or the work you're doing every day to keep it up. And there's I think an interesting point behind all this. And we've seen recently, like in the past year, I think I've seen two or three stories about how, and it's like the headline is just, this just in, parents aren't happy all the time, right? The parents aren't happy, earth shattering. And then the article will go on to say that your studies are showing that parents do have these intense moments of happiness, but they are just often not happy at all. And my reaction is that not life?
Yeah.
You know,
totally.
work and love and everything that you're doing, it's a lot of work. And again, we're using work in the context, of work as something hard.
Well, yeah.
But that there's, you know, happiness is not something that you're experiencing all the time, nor should it be.
No.
That it's, you know, especially when you love something that you do, whether it's parenting, being in a relationship with another person, doing some kind of love that you're passionate about, there are really fantastic highs, you know, and then there's a lot of slogging, you know, there's a lot of effort put in, you know, there's really, you know, I think people get distracted by the idea that whether you're doing something you love professionally or parenting or what have you, that, well, if it's something that makes you happy, it must be making you happy all the time. And in the case of work, it's well, ergo, it does not work because you are just in a happy space all the time.
I think we confuse happy and passion.
Yes.
Right? I think you can be passionate about something. It doesn't make you – you're not happy about it all the time. Like for me, my entire lightning rod is passion.
Mm-hmm.
When I speak, when I write, it is extreme passion for something. And it's rarely positive.
Yes.
But that passion creates contagious energy, which creates that. And that makes me happy.
Yeah.
You know, so
well, it's feeling, right?
Yeah.
And I mean, Aristotle, putting on my, you know, my former academic geek
hat,
you know, he wrote, you know, I think, beautifully and very persuasively in his Nicomachean Ethics, that happiness is not, we confuse, human beings confuse pleasure and contentment with happiness, and that if you want to conceptualize a true happiness, it's something way more complicated than what we think of as pleasure or contentment. Those things are easy to come by.
Right.
You don't have to have your soul or your mind engaged, and you know, for the ancients, those were often very, just very tightly entwined, to take pleasure in things or to be content with things. Animals can take pleasures in things.
Mm-hmm.
Happiness is a more complicated thing that involves deeper movements of the mind and the heart and the soul that involve pain and discomfort.
Right.
And you know, what Socrates called aporia, a space of not knowingness, a space of discomfort. True happiness can be uncomfortable and must be, because it's provoking your feeling and your thought and your mind. And because I think we get so caught up in this, well, happiness is pleasure. And so if you say that, you know, something makes you happy, whether it's your parenting or your work, are you happy? We're thinking, are you in a state of ongoing pleasure and contentment?
Yeah.
Rather than, are you leading a rich life?
Right. And I think that to pull it around to parenting, that's my biggest weakness as a parent, is trying to create happiness for my child.
Right.
That is my job, to create happiness, which also means you think your job is to avoid sadness or anger or something. And I think, you know, our job of parents should be is to allow our kids to experience, period, that's it, to experience whatever there is, and but make them feel safe doing it. And that is my biggest fault as a parent with Owen, is that I try to make sure I shield them.
Yes.
And then that I can give them experiences that are happy. And the problem is, though, like, if I have the means now to do what we want, like we're talking, we talked on the phone yesterday about doing a trip in August to a bunch of baseball parks in the Midwest.
Awesome.
And, you know, renting an RV and just rocking five ballparks in 5 days and a football game. And then, the thing in the back of my mind says, you shouldn't spoil them. Right, you know what I mean? So there's this thing as well, am I trying to force happiness, or is that just awesome, and wouldn't you just love to do it too?
Yeah.
And it's something I didn't do. And so there is that guilt, I find that not so. I don't have, which some people do, you feel guilty working from home or doing that. My guilt happens is am I doing too much? And that's my hardest balance, is not necessarily the work balance with a kid, or mine is, am I overdoing it? On trying to want to be happy for whatever reason that is.
Yeah.
You know, you can take guilt of divorce and all these type of things, background, overcompensation. At the end of the day, I don't know. But I don't know, is I just want to experience the most awesome I can with my son.
Yeah.
And if that's wrong, I don't want to be right.
It's hard, though, when it comes to our children. It's hard to, you know, I can be philosophical about, you know, what capital H happiness involves, and that being a rich life that involves grief and pain and discomfort. When it comes to my children, I am very much aware of skewing towards the small age happy. I want them to be content. I want them to experience pleasure. I want them to live lives of joy. I also want them to have really rich lives. I grapple with it sometimes, because I worry about what that going to mean for them. If, as you know well, I have my nephew, my children's cousin, has a terminal degenerative muscular condition, Duchenne muscular dystrophy. And my youngest, Jasper, 2.5, is not aware that Tanner is dying. My daughter is aware that Tanner is dying. She's aware of the disability, and there are all sorts of things that come out of that. But she's also aware that Tanner is not going to live a long life. And so at 5 years old, we're already needing to have discussions about what that means for her love for Tanner, and how does she frame that within her larger experience of life, and how does she come to, and five is very young to be grappling with these things, and so far it's very much sort of in the realm of, at times, you know, when Tanner goes to heaven, can he take letters to grandpa for me, you know, that kind of thing. But she's still very much aware that, you know, that she's going to miss him. And I spend a lot of time trying to figure out how to protect her, and when Jasper's able to understand it, protect Jasper from the pain that's going to land on her family, and the pain that's already there. And we certainly struggle with how we talk about Tanner when the kids are around, how we talk about struggles. We're all going to Disneyland in a month with a big, you know, just wonderful, wish-fulfilling family trip altogether. But I really struggle between figuring out how to let my children have the rich experience of loving somebody so passionately, knowing they're going to lose them, mm-hmm. And also wanting to protect their hearts, right? You know, and that's where I come up against the big H happy is going to involve grief. Like, they're learning love in such a powerful way because of their relationship with their cousin. But then I'm also like, oh, God, you know, it's...
But you know, but you also know from everybody who has experienced loss in one way or the other that it's helped us make who we are now.
Yeah.
And the, and you know, and the real struggle is maybe it's not our job to tell them how to feel.
Yes.
And that's a tough thing to realize, that it's not our job to dictate how our kids are going to feel, but only allow them to have a place where they can feel it. And that is so huge, whether it means, and I get that now, my son's really getting into sports now, mm-hmm. and watching it, and you know, there's no, the Tom Hanks line, like, no crying in baseball, and,
yeah.
and where should I, you know, should I be telling my son to walk it off and man up and, mm-hmm. you know, and not show that? And I love emotion. I love people showing emotion. I want him, and he's an emotional kid.
Yeah.
And, you know, what is our job? To dictate mm-hmm. emotion. Do you feel, make a feel, try to feel mm-hmm. guilty about crying? Or mm-hmm. And that's why, you know, the default parent is stop crying, stop laughing, stop.
Mm-hmm.
That's to me, is monumental. But telling somebody to stop mm-hmm. feeling an emotion is like telling somebody to stop breathing.
Well, that's stopping, you know, it's putting a barrier on the path to, like, that capital H happiness that we're talking about. You know, if we believe that capital H happiness involves that's an experience of a richly emotional life, then by dictating emotion, you know, we put obstacles in that path, you know, and whether it's what we're afraid of is the sadness, you know, which is something I struggle with, or anger, or any of the emotions that we think are messy, and any of the emotions we want to protect our children from, you know, that gets in the way of that rich emotional life.
And we get, I think, what we talked about before coming on here was, we get exposed more to our kids' emotions now, especially when they get older on, with things like Facebook, with things like where you see wall posts. Mm-hmm. You can see them potentially talking to their friend. Mm-hmm. They hate this, so they hate. Mm-hmm. And if you see your kids say, I hate my life, and you would never be privy to that before.
Mm-hmm.
It's like the social media diary.
Mm-hmm.
And unless you grab the key and the lock it and open it up, you know, as a parent, should we be doing that? But now how do you... Do you friend your kid on Facebook? Do you monitor it? Do you make sure? Because you're trying to protect them from the outside world. But also, what happens if you see something?
Yeah.
Right? Or if your kid is 15 or 16, and you just, since you're a friend of theirs, you see your picture of another one of their friends drinking.
Mm-hmm.
Or they put on, you know, a wall, like inappropriate, or racist, or homophobic, or something like that. Do we have a right, or should we want to see the emotions that our children aren't telling us? Because when we were growing up, our parents got what emotion we chose to show them.
Yeah.
Now we potentially have this little window through that wall now to say, oh wow, I didn't know that was going on. And do we have any business? And there's parents on one side saying, it's my kid, I will do whatever I please about this. And the other side is saying, they haven't chosen to reveal that to me yet. And should I even do anything? But so there, you know what?
It's totally hard. It's such a hard question, because it is. I work very hard with my daughter, who's a very intense little girl, to communicate her feelings to me. So when she's angry, we have an agreement that expressing anger is good, and she should feel comfortable expressing her anger, not in the lashing out in a way that hurts another person, but so it's like, let's have a stomp our feet moment, express your anger. And I do that because I want, you know, I have this powerful desire that when we're in the tweens and teens, that she will come to me when she's feeling something, and she will tell me. However, I also know that there is, you know, for most young men and women, there's actually, I think, something in their DNA that prevents them from talking to their parents about their feelings, right? And so I don't want to push that for her. I'm keenly aware of my desire to be there for her and be her safe place, while wrapping my head around the possible fact that I can't be that for her. That's not going to be my role as she gets older. Mm-hmm. So when you talk about this, now we have this window where we get to see, whereas, you know, my parents often had no idea when I was in pain, when my heart was broken, when I was anxious over something at school. And so there was a little bit of blissful ignorance, I think, for them, right? For us, we're now facing not necessarily being able to be ignorant, but still having to make choices about, do I throw myself in there?
Right. And so is the best method not to be connected with your child on Facebook?
Exactly.
Right. And I think that I know some parents, friends of mine, that run their kids' accounts.
Right.
Like literally saying, I have to have your password, I have this, and like that actually makes it worse.
Yeah.
And for me, I haven't gotten to that point with Owen yet. You know, he's 9 years old. He has a Facebook account because I made it because my friends wanted to say hi to him and stuff like that. And he gets the birthday announcements and stuff. But, you know, do I want to, and that's the choice that eventually that we all will make in this new world is, do I be, am I going to have a limited connection with my child on Facebook or not?
Yeah.
And do I want it weird that my friends will talk to him where I don't know if I want to see it. Like Aiden, who's my son's brother, who I helped raise for just 6-7 years when he's growing up, is my friend on Facebook.
Yeah.
And I am caught off guard every day when he updates. He's 14, right? Yeah. So he's just kicking at puberty. He's just, he's like, you know, which person, which actress is sexier? I'm like, oh God. Like, what is, what, he's still 3 years old to me. And that really is taking me back. And he's not my kid.
Yeah.
But I love him to death. And to have, thinking of Owen's coming through that, I'm like, I don't want to know which, you know, which which Glee actress is sexier. Yeah, but my son thinks it's none of my business. You know what I mean? And that's where I don't know what I'll do then, but I know it's a big problem for parents right now.
Yeah.
Is it is a Wild West because it isn't just a diary anymore under the bed.
No.
It's an open book. And it's, the problem is sometimes the kids are not so blissfully ignorant about what, who can read it.
Right.
And where it goes. So we have this increased paranoia too. And then that protection thing jumps back in.
Right back
I need to watch it to see who else is jumping on there.
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't, and we can't, what makes you great parents is you can't turn that off. I really think so. That, you know, that you have that eagle mentality, that mother hawk over the kids.
Exactly.
And I don't, I wouldn't want to remove that.
No.
You know, to have apathy for what your child's doing or not care. That's probably the worst
it's
thing.
It's better to care too much than to not care enough. But in my case, it's a bit complicated because I, you know, I've written about my children's lives for you know, that we're a true social media family in that, you know, and I you know, my line on that is that I'm not telling their stories for them. I'm telling my own story about motherhood and womanhood and, you know, my experience of life, you know, critically and banally and all those things. But they're characters in my story. So their stories are getting told. You know, they're online already without even realizing it. So we haven't gotten to the Facebook problem yet, but they're growing up being, in some small way, social media personalities. Yeah. Amelia's been recognized in public many times, and she understands that people know who she is.
And flip it, though, they can read your stories about them.
Well, exactly. And so this is the thing, right, is that there's going to be, that lens is going to be turned back.
Yeah.
I'm always going to be in this space, right? They're going to be able to watch me. They're also going to have this whole body of storytelling about them and about my experience of motherhood that means that, and I'm constantly aware of that when I write, that their eyes are going to be on this. And I tell myself that end of the day, I write stories in which they play an important role because they fascinate me. Yeah. I love them. It's a measure of my attention to them and my fascination with them that they are such a big part of my storytelling. However, they're a big part of my storytelling, and they're going to be readers of those stories.
Is the new sending your parents to a retirement home, is the new thing of, I'm going to write a blog about my parents now to get back at them, right?
Well, exactly.
The Her Bad Daughter blog comes up.
The Her Bad Daughter.
Versus
years,
Her Bad Mother, right?
Years later.
That's going to come out. You're going to have the table will turn.
Yeah, so it's not just that, you know, you talking about being able to see your children's feelings, what they're going through. They're going to be able to see yours.
Yeah.
And they're going to be faced with that kind of decision young. We're talking about it now in, like, mid-30s, you know, 40.
Yeah. But you usually have that conversation. Like, my mom and I are having this conversation now of what childhood was like and now. But now we put it out in the on the internet tubes, and that it's there for them to see, regardless of when we think they're ready for it.
Well, exactly.
Right? It's a whole
it's
new
like,
world,
oh, look,
too.
Mommy has an anxiety disorder and needs more Xanax, right?
Yeah. You wouldn't usually get that until you at least 25 and realize that.
Well,
you know,
exactly.
Your parents are loopy, like all of our parents are, and all we are to our kids too. That and I struggle with that too. But the same challenge with Owen, and I call him Un-Junior versus Owen, and how you know, the balance between it.
He's part of your brand.
That's it. He totally is, and my brand is my life.
Yeah.
And that wasn't his choice.
Yeah.
So you know, and so when I now literally when I take a picture or somewhere, he's like, please don't tweet that.
Yeah.
So I'll give him that respect of that. But like how much we've changed to get to the point where your son's asking not to tweet something.
Yeah.
It's pretty amazing.
Well, Amelia says to me, like, no pictures, mommy. She gets all Sean Penn on me. No pictures, mommy. I said, no pictures. We actually, we spoke at Social Media Week the other week. in Toronto, we were asked to speak, but like myself as a social media person, you know, and parenting blogger, and I was asked to bring my husband Kyle and Amelia to say, like, will Amelia have anything to say? You know, so we brought her, and we stood in this, you know, sat on a stage in front of a few hundred people and did this whole discussion of what it's like to be a social media family in the 21st century. And I had, you know, my the stuff I was saying, you know, prepared, holding the microphone, here are my remarks, and I'm going to throw it to my five-year-old to say the few things that we talked about how it feels to have mommy take her picture and do video and tell her stories. And 15 seconds, you know, and then there's like a timer, right, because they're doing it all TED style, you know, how much time I have before I'm about to throw it. She stands up, a couple hundred people, and goes, mommy, I have to go potty. Right now. And my husband, like, could see his face fall. He, like, handed me the microphone because it was going to throw to him after her. It's like, guess we're going potty. And left the stage. And so I ad-libbed for a bit. They came back, and so Amelia.
And end scene.
End scene, you know. And she came back and said her things. But it was a wonderful moment of... you know, that kind of clarity. And you and I had experience with Tanner last year on Blogger, where, you know, Tanner was being interviewed and just all of a sudden went, boring.
I'm bored.
And powered his wheelchair and went out of the scene. And kids really bring us back. Like, I mean, we talk about, oh, they're part of our brand, and what are we doing, and what are all the implications of having them in this world. But they are, I find they actually provide a really much-needed perspective.
Yeah, we don't really, and I don't think we admit to that very much, too, where they help us as much as we want to help them out, too.
Yes.
Totally grounding, totally perspective, and and a pain in the ass, and awesome. You know, all in one bundle, right? That's how it works,
And I think kids actually embody that when we talk about that happiness and work and, you know, work being a word that connotes bad and happiness being a word that connotes pleasure. I think actually children, it's as inspiration I take from my own children, I want to know about the inspiration you take from yours, that they go at play with such an intense seriousness. Yep. There's no distinction between play and anything else. Mm-hmm. Everything, play is serious. If you're like baking something, doing Barbies, doing trains, it's very serious stuff. It's work with a capital W, but they take such immense pleasure in it. And they just throw themselves wholeheartedly into the stuff that they love. And they didn't think to them to distinguish that from other parts of their lives, to compartmentalize it, especially small children. And I really take inspiration from that because it's like, I want to work the way Amelia plays.
Yeah.
Right? And I want to have
that. I want to live the way she plays.
Exactly.
Right? And I had this question 10 years ago with me was, where did we kill the curiosity?
Yeah.
Right? Of asking why. Mm-hmm. And where do we stop asking why? Where do we stop saying, what can I do that's fun today? And then we have to grow up. And we have to, and like, no, you know what? I want to be a Toys R Us kid the rest of my life. You know what? I don't want to grow up. I don't want to do that. And who killed the curiosity? To me, that's the biggest question to me is where on that, and where can we remove that from the curriculum?
Yes.
It's not good enough anymore to, because I started enjoying life once I started having my curiosity back again.
Yeah.
When I started questioning things again. Now, it's difficult with kids because you don't want to question being a parent, but I vowed when day one was born was never to say, because I'm your father.
Yep.
Was my answer to anything. Mm-hmm. Or because I said so. Mm-hmm. I wanted to treat him with respect. Respect is curiosity. And that's the thing that doesn't get talked about with parenting. And that's what I learned the best is keep the curiosity and the passion for stuff. And that's where my inspiration is. There is never a... they're in the moment, and that's probably the biggest thing to me is being in the moment. We've lost that, and we're so iPhone, BlackBerry, everything else that. And at the end, you know, for me, I can conclude the entire thing. For me, is that the day I went to, it was my night to cook, and so of course I went to Denny's, and so Owen and I go there, and I did the most shocking thing ever for a digital adult. I left my phone in the car.
Of course you did.
And by mistake. And I look at Owen and I said, buddy, I left my BlackBerry in the car. Can we just go grab it? And he says, Dad, can we just remember to forget that tonight?
Wow.
And that was just, that was it. And I'm like, oh. And that was just right between the eyes.
Yeah.
And it was not guilt on his part. It was just innocence.
Yeah.
Like, you know what? I would like us to be here tonight.
Yeah.
And from that moment on, it changed my brain. I've turned off audio notifications on my phone. Mm-hmm. I no longer jump like a Pavlov's dog to something, and I'm in the moment. And if we can be more in the moment with each other, instead of having the phone in front of your face while you're talking to somebody face to face, if we can just be in the moment at home and at play and at work, I think life will be a lot better.
I agree. Thanks.
Can I just ask a couple questions?
Yeah.
And you guys can talk to each other, so you'll be facing the mic. Can you just tell talk a little bit about, just for the archive, like what your work is, what you do?
Sure. I run a company called Unmarketing, and it's unofficially known as the Unagency, and everything else with the word un in front of it. It was created to stop hypocritical marketing, where, you know, we market the way we hate to be marketed to. We hate getting a cold call, but we try to do it better for our own company. And we hate, you know, junk mail, but we want to send ours better junk mail. And, you know, and that doesn't make any sense to me. And that was just, like everything in my life, was created out of anger at something. And I decided to stand up there and say, okay, who here actually doesn't like doing these things? And I realized that for every one person that likes cold calling, there's 1,000 who either hate it or will never do it in their lives, even if it means losing a job. That's my audience. That's the people I want to rally around. So I became, you know, I made myself the CRO of Unmarketing, the chief relationship officer, and gone out there and just talk to people. And that's all I do now. I literally just talk. And it's fairly awesome. And my job is to not be the jackass whisperer and rid the world of cold calling, mm-hmm. one jackass at a time.
Was there a particular cold call that you got or had to make, or like something that sort of just...
I started the company when I was in my friend's office. He was working as a sales rep, and we're talking about, you know, what dudes talk about, nothing. And his phone rang, and he was getting cold call. It was like a B2B cold call, which is the, you know, staple of that industry. And he berated the guy. It's like, you know, get a real job and interrupting my day. I have more important things to do. And he slammed the phone down. And I'm like, yeah, I hate those guys too. And literally 5 minutes later, he says, okay, Scott, you got to go. I got to go make my calls for the day. I said, man, you just lost it on a guy and you're going to go do that yourself. And he goes, yeah, but I have a product that they need. I'm like, yeah, there we go. And that was it. And I'm like, there's got to be people out there in the world that don't want this. And like, I knew people who'd get literally physically ill before doing cold calls. But to me, it turned into an excuse. Mm-hmm. Here's a phone book, start dialing, right? You know, it's a lazy man's marketing or sales. And I knew there was a better way. I knew that people do business with people they know, like, and trust. Mm-hmm. And cold calling does not increase any of those three things, right? It's the lowest common denominator. It's the desperation sales and marketing.
Desperation marketing.
It is exactly what, there's a new book right there. you know, and that's what it is. So that was my moment. I knew that I was going to create something to say, no, no more, you know, and that's where Unmarketing. And I picked the name Unmarketing almost a decade ago because I thought it would look good on a book cover. Mm-hmm. And the book came out last fall with it on the book cover. And yes, it looks good.
Nice.
What about you?
I describe myself, and my bio usually says that I'm a mother, writer, activist, ninja, recovering academic, you know, you know, a bundle of things. I lead with mother because I think it's important to give that designation the respect that it deserves. That I think there's power in women and dads in their sphere, standing up and going, I'm a mother and that rocks. That's important, important work. And I started writing about motherhood because I believed that to be important work and those to be important stories. When I was an academic, my area was history of political philosophy, and I wrote about the family and the history of political philosophy and how the family is this important space of raising good citizens, right? Raising good members of society. All those stories have always been told by men, right? Mothers have always been behind the veil of the private sphere. And when I discovered social media and the internet and blogs, it was in a fog of 6 weeks postpartum depression, exhaustion. It was like the heavens opened up. It's like, here is a space for mothers to tell their stories. Right. This is radical. It's never been done in human history. And I like within an hour of finding my first mom blog, I had my own set up and started writing. And it's evolved a lot. You know, it's kind of memoir lifestyle. I write offline. I'm writing a book. I do a lot of social media activism. Scott had success really pretty early and had to adjust to that, but have been able to use my success to do a lot of work in social causes, a lot around my nephew's condition, raising money and awareness for muscular dystrophy, but also for issues concerning maternal health in the developing world. But whenever I talk to people about social good, I come back to the first element for me, which is the storytelling, that real people telling real stories about their real lives is really a radical and revolutionary thing, never been done. Human stories have always been filtered through
channels of
priests and academics and told in Latin and in accessible languages, and they've never been told by the people living the stories. This is a totally new time in human history, and specifically, I think, for mothers who have always been behind the veil of the private sphere, it's completely new. Men have always been able to, no offense, Scott, do not hold this against you, men have always been able to go into the public sphere and speak truth to power to some extent. Sometimes they get burned at the stake for it, not as often as women, but they've always had a space to go into to talk. Women have not, so this is new. So when people talk about, oh, mummy lockers, writing about their diaper bags, they're like, you know what? Whatever the hell a woman wants to write about, she's telling her truth. That
Let
is
her tell it.
Powerful. Tell that it. Is a radical act, as a good friend of mine, Alice Bradley, once said. That's a radical act, to just tell your story.
Can you take me to that moment when you were in postpartum depression and sort of describe that moment and, like, the first blog post that you wrote and, like, what that felt like? Can you take me there?
It was a powerful moment for me because I had been, because I'm an overachiever, I was diagnosed with postpartum depression prepartum. I was like, I was still pregnant when I got my postpartum depression. I am alpha.
Take that.
So I was already seeing a psychiatrist and really struggling with the psychiatric treatment. I didn't want to take the medication because I was worried about the effect on my daughter, my baby. And I didn't like talk therapy. I love talking. I don't like talking to somebody who's sitting there going, and what about your mother? So I was really struggling with it. And they were encouraging me to keep a journal. I'd always been a writer, but I was like, I don't want to just talk to myself. I was struggling. I went online, literally Googling, like, postpartum depression, and I found Heather Armstrong's blog, theDeuce.com, writing about just how fucking hard it was, pardon my French. And I just went, oh, shit, someone's saying that it's hard, and it is hard. And I had not seen it anywhere, even in the what to expect when you're expecting. They're like, you will have some discomfort, and you might have blues. And it was, but somebody was saying it honestly, and it was radical. And the academic in me just went, holy shit, right?
Yeah.
Women have never said this stuff before.
Right.
And like I said, within the hour, I'm like, I've got a Blogspot blog. And it was called, and my mother, my blog now is herbadmother.com. But when I first started, it was The First Days of the Rest of My Life. And
wow.
It was awesomely bad. And I just immediately started going, blah, like just spewing out my experience. Actually, my husband, in the like first couple of weeks when I started doing it, I'm like posting like two or three times a day, just going, blah, my gosh, this is hard. I think I said it more. I think I said it more poetically than that because I am a writer. but my husband would come home from work and go, I was reading your blog and I'm a little bit worried about you. Like, he's like, you know, I'm like, well, I am depressed and I'm in psychiatric care. So, but it was this combination of a sort of a form of therapy for me, but then also like my academic hat, you know, the lecturer in me, the academic in me was going, this is extraordinary. This is what I've been writing about in like the dusty old translating Latin kind of way of like, ah, alas, these women who have never been able to tell their stories. Here I am like, I'm telling my story now. I'm feeling like this is huge. And I threw myself into the experience of actually living something and walking and practicing something that I'd been theorizing the absence of. And it was, my mind was blown so many times in that first year, just like boom, boom, boom. And it just, my mind continues to be blown. And that's why I'm so passionate about it. And why, even if I'm, you know, end up writing like 20 books, and I hope I do, I'm always going to blog. I am always going to blog about motherhood. I am always going, if anyone calls me a mummy blogger, I'm going to say right on. I will own that. You know, because I think there is power and beauty in that, a radical revolutionary power and beauty in that.
That is radical. I dig it.
All right. Okay. Do you guys have anything else that you'd like to say before we end?
Nope. Yeah. I'm good.
I'm good too. And about to do the potty dance. So
yeah, me too.
I gotta go potty now.
Just so that's in the Library of Congress. Yeah.